lessons on places we get stuck. The last 3 weeks we've been looking at sin. We want to continue with that. We've seen so far what constitutes sin, again, by God's definitions. We've also seen the devastation that sin causes, and all sin results in a loss of some kind, whether we fully realize it or not. There's always a loss. We saw last week, we began dealing with how to avoid getting stuck in sin. And we mentioned four things last week, and that is we have to always be aware of the possibility of sinning. No matter where we are, no matter what the circumstances, there's always the possibility that we sin. There's always the possibility that we be defiled by sin. Again, I don't believe that you can walk through this world, through this life, on any given day without contacting some defilement from sin. And then, of course, we sin every day as well. Secondly, we always have to strive against sin, and we saw that how that's illustrated in Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, verses 29 and 30. Thirdly, we saw that we must always avoid sin. That is, we're not to play with sin. We're not to put ourselves in a position where our flesh would be tempted to sin. And then fourthly, we saw last week we need to, of course, depart from sin. Whenever we find ourselves in around sin, we need to depart. When we find ourselves in a place of temptation, a place of defilement, a place of danger, we need to have the courage to flee from sin. Tonight we want, again, looking at ways to avoid becoming stuck in sin, we want to consider two things this evening. Number one, we need to always be aware of Satan's devices. Let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5 in verse 8. We have to be aware of Satan's methods. Very familiar verse in 1 Peter 5, verse 8. It says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary." So we have a common adversary. An adversary is someone who contends with us, someone who opposes, someone who resists, someone who is against our well-being. An adversary is an antagonist, an opponent. And Satan, of course, is all of these things. He then identifies our adversary. Your adversary, the devil, describes his movements as a roaring lion walketh about, and he walks about seeking. He's looking for something. He's looking to do something. Seeking whom he may devour, that is, to consume and to destroy. So we have an adversary. We see in verse 9 that we are to resist him. Whom resist? And the way we resist is to be steadfast in the faith. Faith there referring to doctrine, referring to truth. We need to learn the truth. The truth that we learn, we need to be steadfast in it. That is how we that is one of the ways that we resist the devil. So whom resist, steadfast in the faith. We're told in 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 11 that the devil has devices. Again, we see his intent is to devour, to destroy, to consume. He has devices, that is, he has plans of devouring, plans on how to carry out his consuming of individuals. He has strategies, and I believe he has plans, and I believe he has strategies for each and every one of God's people. The devil really does not, the devil is far more active against God's people than he is lost man. A lost man is already where he wants him. So he's far, far more active with God's people. And this is always so. So he has devices. We see in Ephesians 6 and verse 11, we read that he has wiles. That is, he has tricks. He has deceits. Now his tricks overall and his deceits overall, just like his plans and strategies, really have not changed that much through time, because what he does works. But he does have tricks. He does have ways to deceive. We see in 1 and 2 Timothy that he has snares or traps. He lays his traps in places. He has traps for each and every one of us. We see also, in addition to these, Satan, of course, is an opportunist. He makes full use of opportunity. He makes full use of opportunity to gain advantage and to accomplish his goal. Many times we give him opportunity. Many times we give him way to reach his goal of devouring us. And this is why Paul told us in Ephesians 4 and verse 27 that we're not to give place to the devil. That is, we're not to give him room. We're not to give him opportunity to work in our lives. And we give place to the devil when we do not do what God tells us to do. That gives place to the devil. When we do not submit to God, we've given place to the devil. When we do not yield to God, we've given place to the devil. When we do not mortify our flesh, we've given place to the devil. When we do not pray, we've given place to the devil. God's people give place to the devil all the time, throughout their lives, every single day. Neither give place to the devil, because if you give place to the devil, if you give him space to work, he will work. He will work in your life. And if you look at all, if you look at the times in which you have fallen prey to Satan, if you go back far enough, you will, and you probably won't have to go back too far, but if you go back far enough, you will find that you gave place to the devil. That there was a place that you did not resist. There was a place where you yielded. And Satan has a pattern in which he works. And we can see this pattern throughout Scripture. He has a pattern in which he works, and it's very clearly illustrated in Genesis chapter 3. And we want to turn there in Genesis chapter 3. And we've looked at this in the past, but we see how the devil works. Again, he may use different circumstances. He may use different individuals. He may use different things, but his pattern pretty much stays the same. He has a definite pattern in which he works. And if you and I are always aware of his pattern, we can detect him in our lives. And that enables us to resist. That enables us to arm ourselves. We see here in Genesis 3 that Satan approaches Eve, and he approaches her with what sounds like an innocent question from an interested observer who is really concerned about Eve's well-being. First of all, the devil is never concerned about your well-being. Never. There is never a time when he is concerned about your well-being. There is never a time that he has your best interest at heart. But the devil has a way of entering into a conversation with us. And he has a way of making it appear as a very innocent conversation. He has his people. And there are people who just like the devil, will enter into what appears to be an innocent conversation with you, but there's nothing innocent about it. And they appear to have your best interest at heart, but they don't. They want to gather information. The devil uses these people. Again, people work, the devil's people work the same way he does. So there is a pattern here. We see he approaches Eve with this question. Yea, in verse 1, hath God said. Everything that Satan does, he has a design. He has an intent. We've already seen what his intent is. His intent is to devour. And when Satan asked that question, it was designed to start Eve on a path of, first of all, of questioning God. Yea, hath God said. She starts out on a path of questioning God. You go further down that path, and you find yourself doubting God. So this path leads from questioning God to doubting what God says. Again, Satan desires to create doubt in the minds of God's people. Because if he can create doubt, the next thing that follows is distrust. You begin to distrust what God has said. You call into question what God has said, or Satan gets you to thinking along those lines. Before you know it, you're distrusting God, and that will lead to a disobeying God. It was as if the devil said, Eve, surely you must be mistaken about what God has said. You must be wrong about what God has said. Satan still uses that tactic today. You know, today you look around and there aren't many that are following God's word. There aren't many that are following the standards and the rules of God. And Satan will come and he'll say, you must be wrong because nobody else sees it that way. He begins to plant doubt. He begins to take you down a path. And again, it's always to devour. And Satan will say, let's just talk about it for a while. And again, you'd better beware of entering into conversation with the devil. The best way to converse with the devil, Jesus showed us in Matthew chapter 4, and that is to quote scripture to Satan, and he will flee. He will come back, but he will flee. He suggests by this question that what God has said is subject to our judgment, subject to our evaluation and our assessment, that it is open for discussion. It is his desire to blur our vision with doubt, simply doubting what God has said. That is why people can, I mean, it's black and white, as plain as the noonday sun. And someone will say, well, what does that mean? The devil's been working on them. Well, does it really mean that? You see, that's the tactic of Satan, to take plain English and cast doubt. So he seeks to cast doubt. Secondly, he's always suggesting that God is just a bit too restrictive. In what God said is recorded in Genesis 2, verses 16 and 17, and the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Now notice where God put the emphasis when he spoke those words to Adam and Eve. The emphasis is in verse 16, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat. There's where the emphasis is. You can eat of any tree except for one. But he places the emphasis, you can eat of all of these trees. Now, Satan comes along and he reverses the emphasis. He reverses the emphasis, again, to start Eve down a path. We see in Genesis 3 and verse 1, yea, hath God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden. What God said is you may eat of every tree of the garden but one. But Satan doesn't put the emphasis there. Satan puts the emphasis on the one thing that you cannot do. And there is a purpose behind that. He focuses Eve's attention on the prohibition, that which is prohibited, setting her up to question, to judge, and to evaluate God and his word. The tone of Satan is, Eve, God has restricted you. God is keeping something from you. Let's have a conversation about that. Let's talk about that, Eve. Eve, surely God would not keep you from this tree. Surely God wouldn't do that. That would be unreasonable for God to keep you from that tree. Her focus now is not upon the fact that she can eat of every tree in the garden. The focus is on the one thing that they were not to partake of. It's as if to say, Eve, don't you think that's unfair? Don't you think that's unfair for God to keep you from eating of that one tree? Never mind that you can eat of all the others. But isn't it unfair? And how often people today fall in this trap? They're prohibited from doing something. It's unfair. They don't even consider all the things they can do. They're stuck on that one thing they can't do. This is Satan's tactic. Getting us to dwell upon that one thing, because pretty soon we begin to think, well, this is restrictive. God is infringing on my liberties. And this is unfair. The implication is there is some joy that God is depriving me of. There's some satisfaction that God is keeping me from. God is trying to take away my freedom. And that's why you hear people say, it's my life, I'll do what I want. You see, Satan has got them thinking in this way, that God is trying to infringe on their freedom. That's not what God is doing at all when he makes his laws and when he says, thou shalt not do this and thou shalt not do that. That's not what God is doing. He's not infringing on our freedom. He's protecting us. He's protecting us from ourselves. He's protecting us from destruction. But Satan turns it all around. And the individual begins to think that life isn't fair. And I'm going to start thinking about myself, and I'm going to start enjoying life because I've been missing out. What have you been missing out on? There must be something about that tree, Satan is saying, that God does not want you to enjoy. There's something about that tree, Eve. There's pleasure there. And when Satan, again, gets our mind focused on what we're not to do instead of all the things God has given us to do and to enjoy, we're going down a very dangerous path. Always remember that the prohibitions of God are not there to hurt you. There is not a single command of God, there is not a single law of God that is meant to hurt you. It is there to help you. It is there for your good. Thirdly, we see that Satan suggests that there really is no danger. Now, he notice in verse 4, "And the serpent said unto the woman, Ye shall not surely die." Eve, I know God said you would die, but that's really not what he meant. You will not surely die. In other words, this is why people think that they can do the same thing that has destroyed millions, but they're going to be the exception. Because the devil has convinced them, ye shall not surely die. Ye shall not surely die. God's exaggerating. Mom and dad's exaggerating. People in the church, they're exaggerating. It won't happen to you. He suggests there's no danger. What he's suggesting is, basically, you can do what you want. You can live any way you please. And don't worry about it. There are no consequences. God says you're going to die, but do you really think that's going to happen? Do you really think that's going to happen, Eve? Again, he continues to, he's created doubt, and he continues to feed that doubt. Also, he suggests that there will be personal advantage by disobeying God. Verse 5, "For God doth know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods." That is, your life will be better. "Ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." So what he is suggesting is that you can disobey what God has said, and since God is trying to keep something from you, by disobeying God, you will improve your life. You will improve your life. You will never improve one single aspect of your life by ignoring or rejecting what God has said. And if you think, some people say, well, it proved my life. I'm making more money now or whatever. Oh, you only think it's improved your life. That's another trick of the devil. But you will never, ever improve your life. And you certainly will not improve your standing with God by ignoring or rejecting what God has said. Satan has this pattern. Also, he never has just one person in mind. That's why people, they say, it's my life, I can do with it as I please, as long as I'm not hurting anyone else. You see, sin doesn't work that way. You can't sin without hurting someone else. It's not possible. The devil always has more than one person in mind. You're not that important. I'm not that important. We're not the only ones he has in mind. There are others. Genesis 3 and verse 6. I believe Satan had Adam in mind. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, again, this doubt has been cast. She's now looking at the tree and she's really thinking about it. The tree looks good. And that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise. She took of the fruit thereof and did eat. But it didn't stop there. And gave also, very important word, also. She took of the fruit and did eat, but there's an also. There's more to it. And that's always the case. It's not just that we sinned. There is an also. She also gave unto her husband with her, and he did eat. So we know that Satan had Eve in mind. Satan had Adam in mind. But it even goes further than that, of course. Romans chapter 5. He had the whole human race in mind. Satan never just has one person in mind. Remember that when you enter into a conversation with Satan. Remember that when Satan is attacking you, you're not the only person that he has in mind. There are others. Some of these people, the vast majority of the people that Satan had in mind haven't even been born yet. But they would be greatly affected by what Adam and Eve did. Also, Satan never just has one sin in mind. Satan will always say, it's just one sin, and it's just this one time. Satan never has one sin in mind. And as we've already seen, sin does not stand by itself. Within one sin is a multitude of sins. But Satan never has just one sin in mind. And it's not just for this one time. Yes, it may be one time, but it can have consequences over all time. Satan knows that one sin never stands alone. Adam and Eve, after they ate of the forbidden tree, instead of seeking God, what did they do? They fled from Him. That's a sin. They ate, they fled, they hid from God. That's another sin. It didn't just stop with eating. We see also that Adam and Eve, instead of repenting, they sewed fig leaves together. They sought to conceal what they had done. That's another sin. When you try to hide sin, that's another sin. So we see sin being added to sin. Adam and Eve, instead of taking personal responsibility, what did they do? They began to cast blame. They even cast blame on God. Adam said, "The woman which thou gavest me." He's even blaming God for his sin. So you see, one sin turned into many sins. One sin led to another, and to another, and to another. And on, and on, and on it goes. We must be aware of the methods of the devil. He has not changed his methods. He uses different things. He has more things to use today than he ever has. But his methods are the same. They haven't changed. There's no need to change them because they work very well. Secondly, for tonight, this is concerning avoiding being stuck in sin, we have to not only be aware of the methods of Satan, but we need to be aware of the downward spiral of sin. Sin also has a pattern. And that's why you can look at individuals. You can see them do something. And you can say, this is what will happen next, unless God intervenes. And you can mark it down. You can mark it down. Because sin, there is a pattern. There is a pattern. It is a downward spiral. There are many, many examples throughout the Word of God setting forth the downward spiral of sin. And perhaps there is no better illustration of this than David. David was a man of God. David was a spiritual giant. But David fell. And David would, though he would confess his sin in time and repent of it, he would suffer the rest of his life. And his family was ruined. We could go through all of that, but we're not going to do that. That's not our purpose tonight. But if we turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11, we have the record of David's sin. And again, people who fall into sins such as David did will often say, you've got to believe me, it was not my intent to do that. I believe you. I believe you. It wasn't David's intent at first to commit adultery with Bathsheba. It wasn't David's intent at first to kill Uriah. But there's a downward spiral of sin. And these things happen. How many times we've heard people say, I didn't mean for it to go this far. I believe you. I don't believe many people, or most people, set out and mean for it to go that far. But you get trapped in that downward spiral. And it's almost like you can't get out. You can, of course, because God has provided ways, which we will also see. So, it may very well be that it was not an individual's intent to do something. It was not, they certainly didn't mean for it to go as far as it did. But people get caught in that downward spiral of sin. And we see with David, again, I don't believe that he at first he set out to commit sin with Bathsheba, but he did follow a downward path of sin that moved from a problem or a temptation to a sinful response. When temptation is put before us and our response is not correct, we're going to fall. And now we have, because there was not a proper response, you have an additional problem. Now you have two problems. And now there must be another response, and that response is wrong, and now you have three problems, and on and on and on it goes. This is the progress of sin. We see in verse 1, we mentioned this last week briefly, we see that it was a time for kings to go forth to battle, and we see at the latter part of the verse, but David tarried still at Jerusalem. He failed to follow the path of duty. That's all you have to do. All you have to do is fail to follow the path of duty. Submission to God. And when you do that, you've put yourself in a dangerous place. We see that his priorities were out of line as a result of negligence. He neglected his position. He neglected his duty. The result of all of this was he was in the wrong place. Being in the wrong place will get you in trouble. Being in the wrong place will get you in serious trouble. And what will put us in the wrong place many times is simply not having our priorities right. So the neglect of duty will put you in a wrong place. It'll put you in a very dangerous place. So there's David. He's just relaxing in Jerusalem. The evening comes. David arose from off his bed. No evil intent in his heart. He does not have Bathsheba on his mind. He went outside. He walked upon the roof of his house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself. He saw something. What he saw defiled him. As we went into that last week. But he saw something. Could he, again, I don't believe he went out on the roof that night with evil intent, but he saw this woman washing herself. You say, well, it wasn't his fault that he saw her. Well, let me say this. When he saw her washing herself, thoughts immediately were formed in his mind. Immediately. You may not be able to help what you see, but you'd better beware of this. What you see, immediately thoughts are formed in your mind. Not only were thoughts formed, but there were emotions and desires were formed as well. So thoughts and emotions have been formed. And then notice, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. Now, thoughts and emotions are being fed. That's a step further. That's a step further. You and I may see something. We didn't mean to see it. We wish we hadn't seen it. But you cannot help it. When you see something, immediately there are thoughts. And immediately there are emotions. And if what you've seen is sinful, there is a defilement of the mind. And you need to stop right there and confess it. And ask God to cleanse you of the thoughts and cleanse you of the emotions. Cleanse you of the defilement. Stop right there. But many times we don't stop there. And David didn't stop there. But instead, the woman was very beautiful to look upon. So he did look. He continued to look. He was now feeding his thoughts, feeding his emotions, feeding his desires. This is what Paul warned against in Romans 13 and verse 14. Make not provision for the flesh. Do not make provision for the flesh. Your flesh is rotten. It's corrupt. There's no good thing in it. Do not make provision for the flesh. It'll get you in trouble. And this is what David did. You say, well, he just went out on the roof. He was innocent. Not when he continued to look, he wasn't. He is now feeding thoughts. This is what James spoke of. Keep a mark there in 2 Samuel 11 and James chapter 1. James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust. In order to be tempted, you have to have a desire. If the desire is not there, you can't be tempted. And a man is tempted when he's drawn away of his own lust, his own desire, and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, you see, it doesn't stop. It bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. When David saw Bathsheba, he should have turned away. He should have went back inside of his house, got on his knees, and prayed and drawn close to God. But that's not what he did. He looked, and he looked, and he looked. And David treated temptation in a frivolous manner. He saw Bathsheba. Thoughts and emotions were aroused. David then fed those thoughts, began to feed those desires, and that led to the next step in the process. It says, and David sent, in verse 3, and inquired after the woman. It was the feeding of those thoughts and emotions aroused by seeing Bathsheba that caused David to think about, you know what, I'm going to send and inquire about her. David's a married man. I'm going to send and inquire about her. David now yielded to his fleshly lust. I don't know if David had adultery, if David had plans of committing adultery with Bathsheba at this point, but that's where it would lead. That's where it would lead. I tend to believe that he would just send and inquire about her. But it doesn't stop there. Because now David is under the control of his desires. And once you're under the control of your fleshly desires, you're in a heap of trouble. The very first thought to inquire after Bathsheba should have been resisted. When David went back in his house that night and began to think what he had seen and began to think, you know, I just might inquire about her, he should have stopped right there. He should have stopped before that, but he certainly should have stopped there. But he didn't. He did not resist. He treated temptation in a frivolous manner. And then, through this all, David's heart is becoming harder and harder. And I'm sure that David in his mind had justified why it was right, why there was nothing wrong with him sending and inquiring after Bathsheba. Because that's what people do. They justify it. They convince themselves that in my case, this isn't wrong. And they can come up with some ridiculous reasons. But that's what people do. David disregarded because now he's bent. He's hell bent now. He's bent on fulfilling his desires. And David disregarded the roadblocks of the Lord. If you and I would look at our lives in time of temptation, God always sets up roadblocks. He always does. God's good to us. And he sets up roadblocks. So David sends and inquires after Bathsheba. And word comes back in verse 3 that she was the daughter of Eliam, who was a warrior of David. That immediately should have stopped David right there. How can I do this? There was a roadblock. This, God is saying to David, David, the woman whom you are inquiring after is the daughter of one of your warriors. Stop, David. Stop right there. There was another roadblock. She's also the wife of Uriah, one of your faithful men. This was God telling David, David, stop right where you are. But David's heart is hard, his conscience is seared, and he does not listen. What should have pricked his heart did not. It should have pricked his heart when he found out whose daughter it was. It should have pricked his heart when he found out whose wife it was. It should have pricked his heart the fact that he was a married man. All of this should have convicted him, but none of it did. Because David's heart was hard. Here was God providing a way of escape. This is what God has promised to do in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. With every temptation, he provides a way of escape. The problem is we harden our hearts and we're blind to the way of escape that God provides. This was God protecting David from himself. This was God warning David. This was God instructing David that what he was pursuing was wrong. But David, in blatant disregard, we read next that David sent messengers and took her. David knows a lot more about Bathsheba than he did first. And everything he knows about her should have stopped him. But in total disregard of God's roadblocks, David proceeded on. And notice he was willing to involve others in his sin. People always are. It says he sent messengers. Now he's involved the messengers in his sin. He sent messengers and took her. He involved the messengers. He involved Bathsheba. Later he would involve Joab in his sin. David became so self-involved that he was willing to use whatever he needed in order to get his way. And he was willing to destroy whoever just to get what he wanted. David, a spiritual man, his heart is hard. And at this point, David had no thought of anybody else. The only one David is thinking of is himself. That's the only one. He's not thinking of Bathsheba's well-being. He's not thinking of Uriah. He's not thinking of his wife. He's not thinking of the nation. He's only thinking of himself. Only thinking about pleasing himself. And he's not concerned about the well-being of anyone else. In fact, he's willing to use whoever and whatever he can to get what he wants. This is the progress of sin. David forgot or did not care about his relationship and responsibility to God. 2 Samuel 11 verse 4 says, and he lay with her. And I want to say, before each of these acts, as you follow it through, David could have stopped. David should have stopped, but he didn't. It just kept going downward. He laid with her. He did this in disregard of her. He did this in disregard of her father. He did this in disregard of her husband. He did this in disregard of his own men. He did this in disregard of his own family. And most important of all, he did this in disregard of God. He lay with her. David would then try to conceal his sin. You can read of that in verses 5 through 27. We see in verse 5, and the woman conceived. And sent and told David, and said, I am with child. David has a real problem now. And David would continue to be deceitful in order to try and cover up what he had done. He would send word to Joab to send Uriah from the battlefield back home. And it was his plan that he would get Uriah to lie with his wife. And then he could lie and say the child is his. But that didn't work. Uriah was too faithful. David's plan didn't work. So Uriah in time would go back to the battlefield. And then David, so desperate to hide his sin, told Joab to put Uriah on the front lines so that he would be killed. Just how far sin will go. That's why you need to stay away from people who are hell-bent on fulfilling their lusts, because they don't care about you, they don't care about anybody. All they care about is getting what they want. Your heart has to get pretty hard for that to happen. And it happened to David. And if it happened to David, it can happen to any one of us. And yes, David was forgiven. And David was used of God. And David served God. Wasn't the end of his life. But David dealt with the consequences of that sin for the rest of his life. And even his family, who had nothing to do with his sin, suffered immensely because of the sin of David. If we're going to avoid getting stuck, we must be very aware of how the devil works. And we must be very aware of how sin progresses. And sin always does progress unless you stop. Unless you stop. And I believe if we look back at our lives and we follow the times that we've gotten caught, and we all have been there, we've gotten caught in that spiral of sin. But if you look at it carefully, each step of the way you could have stopped. You could have stopped, but you didn't. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. Brother Jim, if you'd come and lead us.